Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, supporting new approaches to improve health and tackle inequality. In this podcast, David Pentian, Honorary Professor and Associate at the University of Exeter Medical School, shares his thoughts on health, climate change and sustainable development and how to engage policymakers, politicians, the public and private sectors. This was recorded in front of a live audience in Glasgow as part of the GCPH seminar series on the 16th of January 2019.
All I'm going to do is to talk with you, to you, at you, for about 40 minutes, which is just a warm-up, really, for you asking really interesting questions, not just of me, but of yourselves, of each other. So I'm going to do a warm-up, really, now, and just tell you some stories, actually. Would you like to hear some stories? Some stories. So my background is just as a regular, ordinary UK-trained doctor who worked in a hospital. But all the time in my spare time, ever since 1961, I've been a very keen environmentalist. Now, I didn't come to that. I could no less be an environmentalist than breathe. I mean, that was just me. I was a very nerdy kid. But I was always interested in things like Rachel Carson and, you know, things like Silent Spring. And that was me. I was, you know, when everybody else was going to pop concerts, I was going on to demonstrations. And so I was quite an eco-active kid. But then I went to medical school. I forgot everything. It just consumed my life for about 30 years. It didn't worry me because I thought I was doing another good thing. Okay, but there's an important lesson in that, which I might come back to, actually. I'll tell you a story in a minute. And then I got this extraordinary opportunity. Well, it wasn't just an opportunity. I got more and more frustrated that although I was thought I was doing a reasonably good job as a regular doctor and as an epidemiologist working both in this country and in China, I got more and more agitated and anxious that we were not doing enough about one of the most obvious big threats to everything that makes life worth living, really. And I couldn't understand it. And I got more and more frustrated about this. And then suddenly an opportunity came along whereby the NHS in England was going to set up a unit to look at what the effect of climate change was on the NHS. And I thought, it's a sign. It's a sign. So I applied for it and did it. I did it for 10 years. I thought 10 years is enough for anything, actually. Don't do anything for longer than 10 years. So I've just recently stepped down. So being here with you today and tomorrow is a great opportunity to force me to reflect on what did I do? What did we do? Because if we did anything well, it wasn't actually me. It was all the savvy people I managed to get to do it with me, a small team, and people, a network of little worker bees disseminated throughout the country, which was great. But I just want to tell you some stories, which really pertains to the title that you've kindly given me. This is not my title, this is your title, which is how do you engage people? Not what you do. I mean, I think a lot of the science of what we do is pretty obvious. I think if you were a Martian circling the planet and you were looking down on the planet, you would probably say, oh, that's interesting. It's, you know, got a life form. It's carbon-based. And there's one extremely dominant species. And about 200 years ago, they became very rapidly developing because they discovered this black sticky stuff, which has been fantastically good because it's brought untold wealth to about half the planet. Okay? And not only has it brought untold wealth to about half the planet, but actually there is some very serious side effects to using it in the way they're using it. And boy, when they discover the side effects to sort of unleashing this buried sunshine in such volumes, they'll really get their skates on and do something about it. Anyway, the Martians come down and land, and they get out and they pick up a copy of The Guardian and they think, oh my goodness, they understand exactly what they're doing. So the shock is not what we're doing or what we have done, but we're heading to Armageddon knowingly. That is really weird. And that's what I think Martians would find utterly weird. And I think what we should find utterly weird as well. And I think there are probably good reasons. They're sociological, they're psychological, they're way beyond my mind, but the accumulated wisdom we might stand a chance, we might stand maybe a 50-50 chance of getting through this. But I think it's one of the big issues of our time. It's not the only issue of our time. There are other issues of our time, but this is one of the big issues of our time. And there's only so much you can do. So, you know, give your thoughts and your mind and your actions. So just as Duncan said, I hope we'll have a thought-provoking evening. I hope we'll have an action-provoking evening as well. So I hope that you'll be provoked, not by what I say, but by your opportunity to reflect amongst everybody here and the questions you'll ask. So all I'm going to do is tell a few stories. Is that okay? Are you happy with that? Are you all in the right room? Now's the time to leave if you're in the wrong room, okay? Right, so this is the only slide I'm going to show you, which is, you know, science, climate. And I'm sure you're very familiar with this. You know, if we go on like we're going, there's a pretty good chance we're going to, you know, go to hell in a handcart. And we know quite a lot about this. In fact, there's probably no scientific issue on which more scientists than others are more agreed on about where we're going if we do nothing. That is not the issue. The issue is what we're going to do about it. So we and a small team had an opportunity to do something about this in the health world, in the medical world, in the NHS. As you probably know, the NHS is quite big. And we knew that there was a lot of evidence. In fact, all the medical journals are pretty good. The medical journals are pretty good at talking about the problem. And therein lies one of the problems, is that we talk about the problems more than we talk about the solutions, okay? So we have to be solution-focused as well as problem-focused. And there are good reasons for that, often psychological, because if we talk only about problems, you probably know that you'll just drive people's heads into the sand. And as you know, Martin Luther King did not say, "I have a nightmare." You have to have some positivity to it, even if it's almost a pathological positivity. Even in our darkest moments, if you look through history, some people were positive, and in fact, they were right. You never know what might happen, what might opportunity. There's just no point giving up now, however bleak it looks. You need to be positive. So we were charged with the idea of, so you've got this big organisation called a health system. It's got workers of about 1.4 million. It's got a budget of about £110 billion. Surely we must be doing something to counteract what effect climate change will be having on the health service. So when I got the job, I thought, no, actually, it's more complicated than that. We ought to look at the other way around as well. We ought to get our own house in order and say, what is the effect of the health service on what we're doing to our environment? Does that make sense? Okay, so that's very important. It wasn't quite getting our own house in order, but we think, you know, if you've got a budget of £120 billion, surely you must be able to do something positive other than just treat lots and lots of people. So we thought, well, let's pick carbon dioxide, let's pick greenhouse gases and measure the carbon footprint of the health service. No one had ever done that before. So how many people in this room have measured their own carbon footprint? Put your hands up. Okay, pretty good. How many people know what their income is, roughly? Yeah, more. So they're both very important, but bear it in mind that it's really important. One of the things you can do is just measure. Even if it's not entirely accurate, it's a good thing to reflect by measuring what our own organisation or family or person or household is. So we did this in the health service. We've done it four times, actually. And you can see on the graph here, the blue line is how we've tracked along. And look in the bottom right-hand corner, you see the yellow. That's where we need to be, okay? Now, let me tell you, that is not efficiency. That is not doing things a bit better. That's not a few bike racks and a few LED bulbs. That is transformation. That is doing things radically differently. Really, really differently. Efficiency's got a place, but so is transforming it. And we started proposing some really unpopular things, like, wouldn't it be great to have a smaller health service? Now that went down like a bucket of sick, I can tell you. Because everybody always assumes that more healthcare is better. But sadly, better healthcare is better, not more healthcare. Okay? So having done that and really irritated a lot of people because it looked like we were criticising our own health service, all we were doing is being honest. We're just trying to measure ourselves. We thought, where is that coming from? Where is all that? So that is about, what, 32 megatons of CO2 equivalent. Now, what does that mean to you and me? It means nothing because we just aren't really into the metrics of what carbon is all about. I mean, I'd be very impressed if someone knew that was a third of all public sector emissions, but it is. So a third of all public sector emissions comes from the health system. That's a high price to pay. It may be a worthwhile price to pay, but it's still high, and the health service could probably do better. Where does it come from? Well, that blue thing there shows that about three quarters of it comes from buying stuff, and only about a quarter comes from travel or things like direct energy use, procurement. And that's probably the same in our households, actually. And where does all that why have we got such a massive procurement? We spend about £30 billion a year on stuff. And actually the biggest part, so we kept measuring it, and it comes from pharmaceuticals. Pharmaceuticals is very big. It's not the only thing, but pharmaceuticals is the biggest single carbon-intensive product the NHS buys. Now, when we published that, you can imagine how popular we were. You know, so part of this is speaking truth unto power. And what we found is we got really not taken to the cleaners, but I got put up against the wall by certain organisations and said, how dare you, you know? And I said, well, look, nothing would make me happier than if you were to prove me wrong. Nothing would make me happier if you were to prove me wrong. Just repeat it. Repeat the research. Prove me wrong. Go on, do it. So they did, and they got the same result, which was great because it means we didn't have to repeat it. So after that engagement process, we actually got very collaborative with the pharmaceutical system, and we got the 12 biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world around the table and say, listen, we're going to have to do something about this. We're going to have to do it. And it's a slow journey, but we build relationships and we take standards and we've done quite a lot of work and we've now handed it over to other people, which is great. So there's a lot of work going on in that area. But pharmaceuticals is amazing. So in England, we spend about £20 billion on primary care every year. 10 billion of that, a lot of that is on salaries, 10 billion of that is spent on drugs. Half the primary care budget is spent on drugs. Now, here's a question. If any of you are in the research world, this would be a wonderful thing to research, because I don't know the answer, and I think the answer needs to be known, because I think it's one of those facts that will really make people go, oh my goodness, what percentage of pharmaceuticals made around the world, it's a global business, made around the world, end up having a positive therapeutic, so someone's laughing already, a positive therapeutic effect, okay? I don't know what the answer is, but I do know it's small, okay? And I don't think any sector in the world knows what the answer is, but it's horrendously small. Now, it's led me to a feeling that one of the problems with our healthcare system, much as I love the NHS and other healthcare systems in the world, is that we've gone to a place where we're monetizing illness. We are making money out of illness, okay? And there's a big problem there. There's a very big problem there, which we don't have time to go into now, but I would say it's a very worthwhile thing to pursue, okay? But there are places in the world, the wonderful thing about health services is they're so big, you'll always catch someone doing something right. Now, maybe just randomly doing it right, but when you see it done right, and there are parts of health systems in the world where health is monetized. Health is incentivized through a financial mechanism. Now that is quite extraordinary, and it's in one of the wealthiest countries in the world, and it's in one of the poorest countries in the world. Okay, and if we have time, if you want to ask a question about that, please do. Okay, so here's another reason why the health service should be prime movers in this world to a fairer and more sustainable world, and it's this. Now that is a historical photograph, but doctors are trusted. Nurses are trusted. Now, they might be wrong, but they're still trusted. They're still, you know, I mean, we're probably over-trusted, actually. But if you look at the people, the five top groups of people, this is an Ipsos Mori thing, it's done every year. It's called the Veracity Index. The five top trusted professions in the country all reside pretty heavily, four or five of them, in the health system. So the health system has an opportunity, not just an opportunity, I think a duty to use their influence for public good over and above the direct doctor, patient, nurse, patient care, a duty over the good. Now, I think that's really important. So I want to tell you a story, a very quick story, that really shocked, well, it didn't shock me, but it really moved me. Now, about 8 years ago, I got a little sticky on my desk. It said, please ring this number. And I picked up and said, what's this number? And my colleague said, I don't know, it's someone from the Archbishop of Canterbury's office. I think, well, I think they might have the right number, but I'll reply to it anyway. So I replied to it, and it was a chap who's now a good friend of mine called Ian. And he said, oh, I work for the Archbishop of Canterbury, and I'm his climate change advisor. I thought, oh, that's fantastic. That's really good. Because this was an ABC about two or three ago. And he said, now you do what I do, but in the health service, don't you? I said, yeah, I think so. He said, so it must be easy for you because, you know, you know, health, well-being, big workforce, big budgets, people are in the caring, sharing profession. You know, you must have people on side. I said, come and spend a week with me and you'll see. And he said, oh, why? I'm surprised, he said. I'm surprised. I said, no, don't be surprised. I said, how can I put this? I said, I said to Ian, look, I had supper last night with some GP colleagues of mine with whom I used to work. And one of them said to me, David, I really respect what you do. Now, who can guess what the next word is? So he said, David, I really respect what you do, but, you know, I'm too busy saving patients to save the planet. Okay? But it's actually entirely understandable. So, you know, come on, give him a break. But Ian on the other side of the line said, I don't believe you just said that. I said, no, come on, that's perfectly reasonable. I mean, it's a very busy job. I mean, you can't do everything. He said, no. I can't believe you said that because something happened to me. Like, I said, what? He said, well, I was talking to the General Synod in the Church of England, which is the Constitutional Council of the Church of England. And I said, look, I'm going to do a small group for those of you in the room who are interested in climate change, helping me do some stuff for the Archbishop. And one of my vicar colleagues came up to me and said, Ian, I really respect what you do, but I'm too busy saving souls to save the planet. I thought, and so Ian's been my very close friend for a long time now. So it just really struck me that I think there's something, and it's called, there is a phenomenon called the paradox of noble organisations. Have you ever heard of this? The paradox of noble organisations. It means, you can maybe be able to guess what it is. Organisations with really noble aims tend to be terrible employers. Now let me list some for you to save you the agony. Health service, university, charities, churches, faith groups. Okay, the list goes on. But what that led me to believe is, and I've written about this before, that no one's picked it up yet, which is there is something I term moral offset, which essentially means if you're doing good in one part of your life, I've done my bit, I've bought my place in heaven, thank you, I can ignore responsibilities and opportunities in the other side. It's just an idea. I might be completely wrong, but I think it's worth floating. Okay, there's another reason why the health service could do a lot, and that's because even if climate change were not there, all the actions you would take about it, especially around things like energy, around food, around travel, would give you immediate benefits anyway. Okay? Walking more, socializing more, eating better food, better food systems, less fossil fuel, goes on and on and on. So that's the reason. So this is the picture of the synod that Ian Christie gave me. It's great, isn't it? I always think that it was fantastic. So the theme of this talk really is not just that this is a climate change is a scientific or a technical issue. It's a communication and engagement. And it's essentially a political issue. Okay? So don't, much as science is absolutely fundamental to this, it's only one small cog in a very complex system. Okay, you're happy with that? Well, if you're not happy with it, you can object later. So this was brought home to me by a colleague of mine who's a environment correspondent for a national newspaper. He's retired now, fortunately. He phoned me up and he said, listen, David, I've just been to an IPCC meeting, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change meeting in Washington, D.C. I've just got back. And I just learnt something absolutely extraordinary. And I thought, oh, that's odd. Tell me, because he's a really smart guy. He's a fantastic journalist. He said, well, I knew that climate change was an environmental issue, but nobody told me it was a health issue. Does that not strike you as weird? That strikes me as weird. But it strikes me as weird because it's my failing. It's my failing because I'd assumed, because I'm narrow-minded and I'm medical and blah, 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 I assume that if something is an environmental effect, it's barn door obvious, it's going to be a health effect. But it ain't. It ain't. We are brilliant as human beings as compartmentalizing issues. Okay? So I said, listen, if that's the case, you ought to write about it. So climate change isn't just about it, right? It's a health problem. Okay? So isn't that extraordinary? Don't you think that's odd? So assume nothing. Assume nothing. And just to put the icing on the cake about how tricky engaging people and making wrong assumptions, which is where the root of all malcommunication is. I mean, the great paradox of communication is the illusion it's been achieved, because it often isn't achieved in the way you think it's been achieved. So I was telling this story to some colleagues earlier today. I was once invited down to Brighton, to a big conference centre to talk to about 200 finance directors of the NHS. Now, finance directors are influential people because a lot of them go on to become chief execs. Okay, so it's important. Finance directors are important. And I thought, God, this is going to be really challenging because, you know, finance directors, how am I getting an interest in climate change? So I get all the evidence about cost savings, governance, financial prudence, you know, I amassed it all, marginal abatement cost curves, I had it all. You know, all PowerPoints, an hour, hot summer afternoon in Brighton. You can imagine how interesting it was. And afterwards, there was a polite applause. And a guy came up to me and said, I was really disappointed with your talk. So I said, well, I'm very grateful for your honesty, but it'd be useful to know why. He said, because you never said anything about the moral and ethical dimensions of taking action. So it was a big wake-up call for me to do never assume that the people who you're going to work with are going to help you. Don't assume that they are what they are by the badge on their lapel or the sign on their door. We are people first, and then we have these spurious things called jobs and professions and careers, which may completely mismatch our values anyway. Okay, so that's a very important lesson. So I'm trying to give you some lessons and some ammunition to ask, to reflect on this experience you've had and will have, and ask me some questions about it. So I've got a colleague who I wish I knew better, but he lives in North America. He's called Eric Chivian. Now, he is he's a psychiatrist, actually, but he won a Nobel Prize, which is very impressive. Winning a Nobel Prize, you must be doing something right if you won a Nobel Prize. He won a Nobel Prize for starting an organization called International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, okay, which is started a long time ago, about 30, 35 years ago. And he got 50,000 doctors around the world to sign a petition that we should be looking at the health effects of nuclear war. Nuclear war is bad news, very bad news for your health. Okay, and he persuaded the Soviet president and the US president to meet on a ship off Iceland and sign what was called the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks. Is that not impressive? That's it. So give a man a clap, a Nobel Prize, and a crackerjack pencil. Anyway, what he said when I was in a small meeting was he said that was relatively easy, actually. Climate change is tricky. But he told a very interesting thing. He said it's about how you frame it. It's about how you frame it. So he told me the story. He told us the story. Does anybody know what this is? Any biologists know what this creature is? Okay, this is a friend of ours. It's a cone snail. Cone snail, very clever little creature. There are about 200 species of cone snail, and each of them produces 200 unique toxic peptides, small molecules, little chain of amino acids, very toxic, and kills their prey dead. Okay? Now, we've hardly analysed any of these peptides, but we've analysed a few, about 0.5% of all the peptides these cone snails produce. And one of them, we've called ziconotide, is 1,000 times more powerful than heroin as a painkiller. And it's completely non-addictive. That is extraordinary. That's what pharmaceutical companies have been spending squillions on trying to develop for years. It's sitting in a cone snail, okay? This is biomimicry. It's a technical term for this. It's spent millions of years developing, evolving, surviving, dying. The other molecule, we've only analysed a very small percentage of these peptides. Another, it's one species, one set of species. Another molecule is a molecule that treats really difficult epilepsy, temporal lobe epilepsy, which we can hardly treat in any other way. There's a molecule sitting in a cone snail that will treat it. This is great news, fantastic. You know what's coming? In 20 years, these cone snails will be dead, gone, extinct forever, because they all live on the coral reef, which we are very, very quickly bleaching and killing through ocean acidification, okay? Now, because it's got a drug in that's incredibly useful, that's how you engage people who use drugs, like doctors, okay? So you need to make and find and verify and validate the stories, the data, the real issues that will engage the people you want to engage to help, because it's not going to come from one sector. It's got to be truly interdisciplinary. So this is what we evolved in terms of what are these frames you use? What are the entry points? What are the things that will make people say, yes, I'm interested in that? So we listed them. Ideally, the science. I mean, the science is very important, but it's not the whole game. They're the legal issues. There are great laws we have. We're not really using them. Economic, financial reasons. Health reasons, but health is not a big thing for many people. Rights, the moral, ethical. Resilience, security, and there'll be lots of others. So it's really important when you're trying to engage others to understand where other people are coming from. This is not an exclusive list. There's probably a much better list somewhere. So I just want to tell you, before we open up into questions, show you a few other little stories that I've used, and I pinch most of them from other people. You know, it's either called sharing or stealing intellectual property, but it's very important to understand what engages people, because what you think is important may not be important for other people. So this is a picture. I don't know how well you can see this. This is a cartograph of the world where countries change in size depending on their emissions. Okay, and broadly, wealthy countries emit more than poor countries. Okay, can you see that? You can understand that, can't you? I don't think this is historical emissions. This is just emissions at the moment. But what I want you to look at very carefully is the next slide, which shows you where people die through climate change related mortality, which the World Health Organization treats as very important, obviously, but it has good data on this. So can you see that? So keep that in your mind and watch the next photo, the next picture, and see if you can see the change. So these are people who produce greenhouse gases, and these are the people who die. Okay? Now, sometimes what you have to say is, this is not right. It's not a technical issue. It's not even a political issue. It's hardly a matter. It's just, that's not right. So, and also, I hope you won't forget that. I don't think you can walk out of this room and say, I'm going to forget that. I'm going to blate it. Okay? So that's an ethical thing. So another equivalent thing, and this is, I'm talking about engaging doctors here, because some doctors are fantastic at this, but many are not. Many are not. So this is, I didn't know this, but half the surgical instruments, these are the things that operate, surgical instruments, expensive, very, very carefully made, start their life in northern Pakistan, in a place called Sialkot. You may know it. It's famous for a number of things. But one of the things is it makes half the surgical instruments in the world, and half of those instruments are made in the most appalling conditions, where these kids are paid less than a dollar a day and are going to lose a finger or an eye because of hot metal fragments shooting into their eye. Okay, they're going to lose that. And that's where a quarter of all surgical instruments in the world start. That's not right. That is not right. And we could do better. If anybody's worked in procurement and supply chains knows that it's hard work, but you could do better. And this person, who's an ENT surgeon in Brighton, has worked tirelessly because his cousin lives in this place, and his cousin took him there, and he saw it, and he thought, I'm going to work very, very hard to start an alliance between the British Medical Association and Royal College and get this thing sorted. Okay, just pick off one thing. This needs sorting. Fantastic. You know, another hero. Make the financial case. But the financial case won't make room with other places. But this will. And this is a really important principle of engagement, which I think a lot of us get wrong, which is how you move from why we should act to how we should act. A lot of us are very good on banging on doors and saying, we need to act. And one day, you're going to knock on a door and a minister is going to say, okay, fine. What are you going to do? You need to be ready. You know, here's £5 billion. What are you going to do? If you think, wait a minute, we need to go away and think about this, you're going to lose the opportunity. So moving from why to how is another important engagement technique. And I've seen it. This is all this is called a wedge analysis, by showing where you, if you take action, it'll have this amount of effect. You needn't worry about the details so much, but it shows you where things at the top of the graph, which will happen nationally, like, you know, grid decarbonisation or massive vehicle efficiency, you know, these are transformational things where we change the grid. And things at the bottom where the health service has a contribution. And there's still a gap. We've modelled this and there's still a gap. So we would need to work a lot harder on this. But finally, I just want to show you some examples, some good news stories, because you don't want to go out of this room thinking, oh, we might as well eat, drink and marry and die. Because there are some really good, so I'll just show you a few stories. Are you okay for a few good stories? Okay, so if you're feeling bad. So this is a photograph of a hospital. Now you can tell it's a hospital because it's got a massive car park. And it's a terrible hospital. It's not fit for purpose now. It's built in, you know, in the 19th century. So they need a new hospital, okay? So here is the new hospital. Can you see that? It's beautiful. It's a beautiful new hospital, much smaller. The issue is, what do you do with the old hospital? That is impressive, okay? So a lot of the transformation is about stopping doing things. It's actually quite easy to do new glitzy things if you've got the budget. What's really difficult is to say to people, look, what you've been doing for 30 years is great, but we're not going to do it anymore. Okay, thank you, goodbye. It's very difficult to do that. It's very, very difficult. Now, that is actually a children's hospital. And the people who are on the planning of that included children. If you ever had children on the planning committee, it's very interesting because they say things like, I'm 8 years old and I'm not going to share a ward with a seven-year-old. You think, okay, fine. And here is one of those people who was a patient, is now an architect. He was a patient in that hospital, is now an architect. It's great, isn't it? Isn't it great? That's great. So here is this is in Northern Ireland. This is a hospital, can you believe it? Okay, they put in this turbine. Why did they put in this turbine? For financial reasons. Because it paid for itself in less than 2 years. It covered its cost in less than 2 years. Not only that, it's what we forget is when you make an investment, it pays back in 2 years. Every minute and day and week and month and year subsequently, it makes you money. Okay? It constantly makes you money. So this wasn't done for sustainability reasons, but it's a nice byproduct, isn't it? And also, when you go to a town and try and find the hospital, you normally follow the chimney, don't you? Yeah, so you can follow the turbine. Okay? So that's great. That's fantastic. So look at it globally. So here's an interesting story. Probably some of you in the audience will know what this is. This is CSP, this is concentrated solar power. It's not very difficult technology, actually. All that is a big concrete, it's actually quite big, concrete with something at the top like liquid sodium that's melted by the sun shining all those mirrors. The most complex thing is the computer, which is about this size, which controls all those mirrors. Not tricky, very easy to do. And someone to keep the mirrors clean with a feather duster. And that is quite tricky, actually. But it generates a lot of power, and it's very easy technology. And it's one of many sorts of renewable energy, which many of you will be very familiar with. So let's have a look at Europe. Let's have a look at Europe and how many of those you would need to power the whole of Europe in 2050. Not now, in 2050. Now, to power the whole of Europe through a very resilient network, of DC supergrid, not tricky. It cost a few trillion, not a lot of money on a global scale. You need something about the size of that second red blob, okay? That would do it. That would do it. That's quite a big blob, actually. It's not difficult. It's not, we're easily technically possible. Not only that, you would get some shade. You would dump the excess energy into the seawater, desalinate it, grow crops in the shade, provide jobs, provide food. It's great. But the really good thing is this. If you move all that energy north, what's going to move back the other way? Money. Money. Now that is very important because you do not want to set up a sort of false dichotomy where people say, no, world poverty is more important than climate change. These issues are all intimately connected. So you need integrated solutions that suit many people. Now, this is a classic example of a phenomenon called contraction and convergence, which some of you may know, but if you don't, it's worthwhile because it's a system-wide, globally tested process for addressing probably one of the two biggest things that a Martian would see from their spaceship, which would be, this is weird, they're burning fossil fuel like there's no tomorrow, and if they do it, there will be no tomorrow. And also they've got this global village, everybody's got a mobile phone more or less, 80% penetration of the world, and you've got obscene differences in opportunity and wealth and education. But this is an example of an intervention that will address both simultaneously in an integrated way. Now, I'll leave it to you to say, why the hell is this not happening? And who is objecting to it? And what are the barriers? And why didn't we do this 20 years ago? Okay? Unfortunately, all the countries around the, you know, we have got deserts all the way around the world. You know, if you were really into faith, you'd say some designer put these deserts all the way around the world so that, you know, the sun is shining on two of them at any one time. So if you're a global supergrid, we could easily decarbonize the global electricity system. We absolutely have to do that. How are we doing for time? Are we okay? Okay. So let's come closer to home. This is QMC. This is Nottingham. I'm just telling you this story because a lot of people aren't interested in climate change, but they are interested in things associated with it, like travel, like energy, like food. And another hero of mine called John. So John came to this hospital from John Lewis. John Lewis is, for those of you who don't know, a big retail organization with an interesting partnership business model. And when John came as deputy catering manager, he looked in the foyer and he thought, sorry, you got Starbucks, Burger King, McDonald's. This is a hospital. Interesting. So John, being a very, you know, canny guy, said, let's ask them all to leave. Let's break their contract. So the first thing he did was make himself really unpopular because people couldn't get coffee. And that, you know, you're treading on thin ice here. So he put his own coffee shop, Fair Trade, Rainbow Alliance, coffee, cheap, good. And then he let all of them back again, but he just kept undercutting the price. Okay? So he played them at their own game. Anyway, he had a bit of fun and games with this. And then he looked at the food on the ward and he thought, this is interesting. Did you know that the NHS in England is the biggest buyer of food in the country? That's interesting, isn't it? It's the biggest buyer of food. See, NHS is big. It can move things. But interestingly, most of the food served on wards in English hospitals is made in another country. It's made in Wales. And it's shipped in the night through big trucks in plastic containers, cooked, chilled, and delivered, heated up, and dumped in front of patients in English hospitals. It's not that great. So John went out to local farmers in Nottingham and said, hey, how about you make food, dairy, meat, veg, for us, and we'll serve it in the hospitals. And the farmers went, whoa, hold on a second. We've never tried to break into the NHS as a market. He said, I'll help you do it. So now John monitors how much food is local, how much is organic. And he monitors, and it's great. And, you know, objections came through and said, And this is a really interesting thing about engagement. People said, oh, patients won't like it. I said, why not? They said, well, it'll have to be seasonal. So I'm not sure we can support this because patients won't like it. So John said, have you asked patients? And they went, no, but we can be pretty confident they won't like it. He said, I've asked them and they're fine with it. Okay? So if you're seeking mandate, ask, consult. It's just so blindingly obvious, isn't it? But it'll give, not only will it give you mandate, it'll give you even better ideas. Because if you consult well, people say, not only should you provide us with nice food on the wards, but my relatives have to go to a rubbish canteen. Why don't you do it in the canteen as well? So he did it in the canteen as well. And the food in the canteen became so good that members of the public started coming into the hospital, into the canteen. And everybody said, this is outrageous. And he said, I think it's quite a good idea, actually. We can open up the canteen as a community asset and stop people being frightened of the hospital. It's a community asset. Come in and have good, cheap food. And if there's any profit, you know where the profit's going. It's going into your hospital. And because he had to get the kitchens back in, he had to get people back in to cook, so he improved the employment. This is a good news story, okay? The sad thing is, we don't replicate this. We see something, and we've given them an award. He's got a Soil Association Good Award. We should be not just giving John an award. We should be going around to other hospitals and saying, excuse me, we'd like to know why you're addicted to a system which could be better. Okay, so we need to reward the best, but we need to use those best to normalize. This should be normal. This shouldn't be outstanding. It is outstanding, but outstanding should be normal. Okay, so a colleague of mine called Ed Maybach, runs a university department in America, which is about climate change advocacy. And I asked him to distill his years of work onto one slide. Okay, it's always a good challenge to try and do that. Simple, clear messages, repeated often, consistently by trusted voices. Okay, we did it for tobacco. We've done it for quite a few things, but we have not done it for many things. We're inconsistent, and we are always cleaved apart by headlines such as "Scientists disagree." Okay, that's merchants of doubt stuff. You know, people who like to stop action, saying, "Well, we're not absolutely sure." Well, I'm afraid we're sure enough. Okay, anyway, I thought you'd like to see them. So these are the laws we use in England. So these are really important laws, and we don't use them enough. Public sector bodies are required. It's the law. So when somebody says to us, me occasionally, when I worked in the SDU, they said, why should we do this stuff? I said, well, it's the law. I mean, you can break it if you like, but survival is not compulsory. You can be fired. And most chief execs do not like to break the bank, and they do not like to break the law. So if you want to use levers, use the bank, use the law, if they exist. This is a fantastic piece of legislation. This is what small countries like Wales and Scotland can do well. This is an outstanding piece of legislation that only two countries in the world have got. It was actually quite easy to pass, because who would argue that the well-being of future generations is not important? And every piece of legislation in Wales now has to go through this. That's great. That's great. And of course, you have things like this, which is better than the Climate Change Act in England, incidentally. You probably know that. So don't forget that you have to create future truths. You have to create the world you want to see. And you have to not over-rationalize it. You sometimes just have to do it and normalize it through doing it, as Jerry Sterling would say. So remember, emotions drive people and people drive change. This is not just a technical issue. We did a public opinion survey because we sought mandate, public opinion. And people said to us, you can't do what you want to do in the NHS because the public won't like it. How do you know unless you asked? Go back to ask people. And you'll get good ideas as well. It's fantastic. Anyway, lastly, you get very influential people to stand up, speak up, act up about these issues. That's very important. So we had our chief medical officer, we had the chief executive of NICE. We just went to see them and said, would you mind saying something about this because you're influential? And they all rose to the challenge. So the worst that can happen is they can tell you to go away. But the best that can happen is to say something really important. Okay? Royal Colleges do it, and it doesn't have to be on climate change, it could be on air quality, air pollution, which is a very good entry point. So, that is what we started with the NHS, which is high quality care for all. And that's where we ended it. Now and for future generations, you've got to bring the future into our current responsibilities. I'll skip that one, but actually I want to finish. Can I just finish with four slides? Because one of my particular interests is, as you can imagine, how you engage people. And I'm very interested in how we use humour. Humour is not a trivial thing. Humour is a deadly serious game. It's one of the best, probably one of the best engagement issues, especially around this issue, because it's scary and you've got to make it less worthy and scary and strident. So I'm going to show you four slides, some of which are well known, but I would strongly recommend you think carefully about how you use humour, not to trivialise it. Don't do it in a way that makes this issue look trivial. It is not trivial. It's about the future of and our legacy that we'll leave. So I'll leave you with these four. And if you have any thoughts about how we use humour cleverly, because I've learnt a lot about communication from stand-up comedians. I'm not a funny guy, but stand-up comedians think about communication far more than anybody in this room probably thinks about communication. They can understand an audience, they can read an audience, they know where to trigger points are. They're great. So if you've ever seen Armstrong and Miller do a sketch on climate change, if you haven't seen them do it, go and look on YouTube and you'll see. And it's a very, very clever thing. It's a far clever than any of the stuff we're doing. Okay, so some of you may have seen this. Okay. These are all things I've just seen around the world. So the last one sums up a phenomenon which I think is the last reason why the health system should step up to the mark, which is about the many benefits of acting even if climate change didn't exist. So I'm going to stop there and just remind you that over 200 years, health professionals have taken action in a wide era, maybe outside what they thought there was a remit, but actually, sometimes well and sometimes not so well. But I'm not sure we're stepping up to the mark with this one. And I don't think historians will judge us lightly if we think, too difficult. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Glasgow Centre for Population Health podcast. If you would like to find out more, search podcasts at gcph.co.uk.